our star poet and professor, HSC professor Barbara Curiel. She will be here presenting her poetry, and we'll have more information about Barbara and her background. But I wanted to take a moment. My name is Teresa Bruneau, Dean of the University Library, to simply welcome you to this afternoon of poetry, cheesecake, and fellowship. And with that, I would like to take a moment and introduce, and thank our president, President Rollin, for joining us for this poetry reading. Thank you very much. And introduce our provost, Dr. Robert Schoener.
Thanks, everybody. It's great to see so many folks turned out. I just want to take a moment and congratulate Barbara on winning the 2012 Philip Levine Prize in Poetry. As you might suspect, it is named for Philip Levine, who, among many other honors, won the National Book Award twice, the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, and was the Poet Laureate for the Library of Congress. It's a highly competitive and prestigious prize. There were over 650 entries this year, and all of these entries were fully done manuscripts of poetry. The winner received a cash prize and publication by Ahinja Press, which has been publishing fine literature for over 40 years. We are indeed fortunate and honored to have an accomplished poet on the faculty of Humboldt. So congratulations, Barbara.
And Katie Boots for organizing the cheesecakes and other food. And thank you to the Dean of the Library, Teresa, and Mimi Watanabe Shock for letting us host this wonderful event at the library, and for dedicating your National Poetry Month poetry reading to our own local, national, and transnational poet, Barbara Brinson Curiel. My name is Christina Accomando. I'm a colleague of Barbara in her multiple departments. And it's my honor to introduce my brilliant and prolific colleague who came to HSU in 1997, already an accomplished poet with degrees from Mills, Stanford, and UC Santa Cruz. Barbara Curiel's first volume of poetry, Speak to Me from Dreams, which is available here and can be signed by the author, published by Third Woman Press, weaves together multiple themes and tones and perspectives, offering diverse poems of beauty, resistance, contradiction, life, family, humor, and food, which is an increasingly salient image in her work, so it makes sense that we have fellowship and food at this event. And one of her upcoming publications is an earlier poem that's going to be reprinted next month in the Anthology of Latina Poetry, Recipe Chorizo con Huevo Made in the Microwave. So an example of her culinary poetry. Barbara's poetry also appears in numerous journals, anthologies, chapbooks, and the Canto Mundo Poetry Lab electronic workshop, which came out of a fellowship that she did, a master's poets workshop with Canto Mundo, a national organization for Latino and Latina writers. And I love that her media includes virtual electronic spaces, like an electronic poetry lab, as well as utterly material places, like a paper chapbook held together, woven together with actual sticks of wood. And I couldn't find my copy of that chapbook of yours, but it's a piece of beauty as well as literature. An active teacher and scholar, Professor Curiel serves all three pathways in the English major, including helping us to revamp our writing practices pathway and going to national conferences to work on that issue. Advises master projects in the English department, chaired ethnic studies for many years, helped to build the ethnic studies program, and helped to create the recently formed Department of Critical Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, providing curriculum and leadership and advising and numerous other things, while also publishing poetry scholarship and multiple blogs as a quilt maker and textile artist. Her fiber work ranges from wearable art and a handmade cloth Julia Child doll to a collaborative Virgin of Guadalupe quilt created with an online quilting comrade in another state, impressively combining low and high-tech communication. As I understand it, and you can ask her questions about it, they individually make these amazing blocks with fabric and thread and lots of other material, post electronic images on their joint quilting blog, post writing about the visual images, but also take the fabric block and put it in snail mail and mail it across between Humboldt and Houston, Texas, so they can physically add to each other's physical work, which I think is quite an amazing feat. LadyGuadalupe.blogspot.com if you want to take a look at these amazing images. I'm not sure how she finds time to do all of this, although I've noticed that she will bring knitting to a meeting, and after 2 hours of scheduling or assessment or program review, I leave with a headache and she leaves with a shawl. So I think it's a very conscious technique that she has. Professor Curiel creates and teaches courses ranging from beginning creative writing, advanced poetry workshops, Chicano and Latino literature, women of color feminisms, Japanese-American internment, U.S.-Mexico border, and many others. She brings all these areas of expertise and creativity, all these lenses and languages, to her most recent manuscript, Mexican Jenny and Other Poems, piecing together history, legend, fiction, and other fragments, both excavating buried histories, embroidering new histories, and imagining new futures when needed. Mexican Jenny and Other Poems is the book that Cornelius Eady, acclaimed poet and the final judge for the Philip Levine Prize this year, selected from an original pool, as Bob said, of more than 650 manuscripts submitted. The book will be published in the fall by a prestigious press, but we get to be an advanced audience for this amazing work this afternoon, so please join me in welcoming award-winning poet Robert Levine.
From the library, Kumi Watanabe Shark, who's a tireless promoter of poetry at HSU. Also, my very kind and generous colleagues from both departments of English and CRGS for their support, their tireless enthusiasm for my work. Especially Christina Accomando, who insisted that we had to have this event. And you know you don't contradict Christina when she gets an idea. And also for Katie, who did the legwork for this event. Thank you so much. I'd also like to thank my students for coming and my family who's here. Also for supporting my work. I'm going to read from the new manuscript, which is very much a work in progress. Until the ink is dry, it's all, you know, it's a moving target. But I thought I would read a couple of poems from different parts of the manuscript, and then I want to read the title poem, which is a longer work. The first poem I'm going to read actually is very much a poem that comes out of HSU, and that is a few years ago, my colleague Ramona Bell was hired. And she doesn't know this poem, but she when she was hired and was moving to Humboldt, I tried to help her find a place to live before she arrived. And so I wrote this poem out of an experience that both she and I jointly had in that process. And it's called Family Picture. And the idea of photographs and portraits are a reoccurring topic in this collection. Family Picture. I'm helping Ramona find a place for her family so she can move from Ohio to California to take her new job at the university. A landlord shows me the one apartment I've seen with a clean kitchen stove. And then he calls Ramona to request a picture of her family. Email is fine. So he'll know what kind of people they are. Ramona tells him she teaches about inequality and justice. She tells him she worries about prejudice. Oh, no, he says. With an immigrant's accent, I wasn't able to place. I'm not prejudiced. Just send the picture. So that one's for you, Ramon. And I'm going to read another poem, which is about my childhood, and it's called My Father Comes Home from Work. My father comes home from work, sweating through layers of bleached cotton t-shirts, sweating through his wool plaid shirt. He kisses my mother, starching our school dresses at the ironing board, swings his metal lunchbox onto the Formica kitchen table, rattling the remnants of the lunch she packed that morning before daylight, crumbs of bologna sandwiches, empty metal thermos of coffee, cores of hard red apples that fueled his body through the packing and unpacking of sides of beef into the walk-in refrigerators at James Allen and Son Meatpackers. He is 26. Duty propels him each day through the dark to Butchertown, where steers walk streets from pen to slaughterhouse. He whispers Jesus Christ to no one in particular. We hear him, me, my sister Linda, my baby brother Willie, and Mercedes, La Cubana's daughter, whom my mother babysits. When he comes home, we have to be quiet. He comes into the dark living room. Dick Clark's American Bandstand lights my father's face, white and unlined like a movie star's. His black hair is combed into a wavy pompadour. He sinks into the couch, takes off work boots, thick damp socks, rises to carry them to the porch. Leaving the room, he jerks his chin toward the teen gyrations on the screen. Says, I guess it beats carrying a brown bag. He pauses for a moment to watch. I grew up in San Francisco, and so, hometown, huh? I wrote this other poem also about my childhood in my neighborhood, and there's a couple of historical kind of references in this poem. One is when I grew up, we had this neighbor who was a whaler, and thinking about it and thinking about writing this poem many years later, I started to do research about whaling, and a lot of the initial research that I looked at said that no whaling had been done on the West Coast after the turn of the 20th century. But then after I dug a little deeper, I did find, you know, evidence that, yes, my experience was true, right? This neighbor was a whaler. And so that's one of the details, that in the 1960s, there was still whaling going on. And in the poem, it talks about what's done with the whale products. Another historical detail is that I grew up in these flats, and we lived downstairs, and these neighbors lived upstairs. And in those buildings, there's a front door and then inside stairs. And a lot of these old buildings had this lever at the top of the stairs so you can open the door without going down. Huh? And in another place where we lived when I was a kid, the lever was broken. But these neighbors, they're still work. So the lever is in the poem. And then the other thing is that this poem came out of a workshop that I took with Benjamin Alita Sines a couple of years ago. And his prompt was to write a poem about rage. And so this is my poem. And it's called Arrival, San Francisco, 1965. Tano stumbles home loud and late, drops his keys on the pavement, calls up the stairs for Kay, his wife, to pull the lever, unlock the door. In the morning, she runs a tired hand through over-permed hair, lipsticks her crooked teeth, grumbles out the door to the factory, leaving her old mother in front of the TV. Usually, it's just her and her mother at home over onion sandwiches, card games, and early nights. Usually, he's out at sea whaling, hunting sperm, humpback, and fin for Del Monte's cat food, chasing sperm whale oil for nuclear reactors. But then he returns, a broken vessel of a man with a dream-shattering voice, listing in the late-night breeze. She bides her sleep-deprived time until his next departure, when man-eaters will again circle his ship. I'm going to read the title poem. I'm going to read most of it anyway. Mexican Jenny. And I discovered the story of Mexican Jenny, who's a woman who, her name was Jenny Wenner. Years ago, I first heard this story when I read a back issue of a textile arts magazine. There was a brief announcement of a quilt exhibit in Colorado, which included a quilt that Jenny had made in the 1920s when she was incarcerated at the prison in Canyon City, Colorado. According to the article, Jenny had been a prostitute in Cripple Creek, a gold mining town, and she killed her husband with his own gun after he beat her up for not bringing home enough money. She was convicted of murder and in prison made a crazy quilt from her working girl clothes, complete with the embroidered image of her dead husband. When she contracted tuberculosis in prison, the quilt was sold and the money used to send her to Mexico, where she spent her last days. So that was what was in the original article. And again, because when I teach, I like to pass things around, I brought a sample of a crazy quilt. And this is one that I made, so it's not related, and it's not related to this poem. It's upside down, I think. But crazy quilts are pieced together with just different scraps of fabric. In fact, this one is, some of the pieces are old neckties. And so they're pieced together and then embroidered, hand embroidered. So I'm just going to pass this around. If you go to quilt shows, usually somebody with white gloves will be there, but we won't do that to show you things. So anyway, so this is what I knew about this woman and her story. And the story haunted me. I wanted to know who this woman was, what brought her to Colorado, what brought her into the life of prostitution. Over the years, I made a few efforts to research her story and found no record of her. About 2010, I used the original bare bones of this story and began to flesh it out with my own imagination. Because Jenny was sent to Mexico at the end of her life, I created a Mexican early life for her and motives that would lead her to Colorado. When I was writing the part of the poem about her time in Cripple Creek, I researched the lives of prostitutes in Western mining towns, and I ran across Jan Mikkel's book, Brothels, Bordellos, and Bad Girls, Prostitution in Colorado, 1860 to 1930. And Mikkel had a four-page account of the case of Jenny Wenner, which gave me various facts of the case, including a dramatic mugshot in which Jenny defiantly looks into the camera lens, and as well as two more sedate prison photos of her. Some of the details from Mikkel's account contradicted my own story, like the revelation that Jenny was actually born in Colorado. However, she gave me a timeline to work with. She killed her husband on Christmas night, 1913, and entered prison in May of the next year. Some facts of Jenny's case are woven into my poem, And others, Jenny disputes in the poem in her own voice. Because of these conflicts of fact, folklore, and interpretation, the poem is also told in multiple voices. And I've given her story three different endings. There's a reference in the poem to a photograph of a sewing workshop in the prison. And this photograph was published in Sandra Dallas's book, The Quilt That Walked to Golden, Women and Quilts in the Mountain West. And the same photo and other details about the prison are from the book Prisons of Canyon City by Victoria Newman. So this ended up being a heavily research-oriented project. And the poem starts with an epigram from Dorothy Allison, one of my favorite writers, from her book Skin. And Dorothy Allison writes, "I read about it in the paper, two paragraphs. I have carried that story with me ever since, wanting more, wanting no one to have to be those two stark paragraphs." Mexican Jenny. And there's about 20 parts to this poem. "Girls like me come from alleys, from dirt floors, from cold kitchens, from one thin blanket. Girls like me come from fists, from passing strangers, from wandering fathers, from mothers with one heel hooked on the bar stool. Girls like me come from drought, from war. When I was a child in Acapulco, I worked for a rich family, sweeping their kitchen, washing their dishes. One day, after a few nips, the cook, who was a friend of my mother's, had said, 'Come work for me in the big house.' I stood on a wooden box, washed dishes stamped with indigo trees and flowers, with birds like none I'd ever seen. I stood elbow deep in dirty water, dreamed of far places without greasy pans nor the boss's wandering hands. The boss's wife had a red silk shawl embroidered with many colored swallows. She draped it like a flag on the back of her chair. It had come on a ship from Manila, from that land of shipbuilders and sailors, of travelers who years before brought Chinese porcelain and silk to Acapulco. Every time I walked by, I fingered its edges and felt like I was dipping my fingers into the tide. After I'd found the fault lines in one cup too many, when I daydreamed one dish too many to pieces, the cook ran me off, but not before I pinched that shawl, wrapped it around my waist under my dirty skirt. Running home, the silk rubbed my legs, a river current. That's when I took to the road, the shawl with swallows darting between thin trees stuffed at the bottom of my morral. In 1907, I left my home, crossed the narrow border that intersects splintering sidewalks of faded towns. If I'd known I left my country, I'd have crossed myself as I passed from one land to the other. Men's quick fingers are dangerous as lit dynamite, but I was a snake and slipped through. Sometimes I dressed as a boy in two big shirts, in trousers yanked from backyard clotheslines, in boots snatched from just inside back porch doors. I stole what I did not find. When I had to, I worked. I traveled to a land named in my language that travelers pointed to with crooked fingers, Colorado. In my mind, it was paved in red velvet and hibiscus flowers. But when I got to those gold mining towns, I found dust, tubercular coughs, ragged men buried daily in the mines, and women whose every mouthful depended on what was brought to the surface. I hung gray sheets in the muddy yard of one of the best whorehouses in Cripple Creek. I heard his step on the gravel, saw his slim outline cut a dark slit into the bright morning. I could not tell if he was man, woman, or coyote standing on hind legs. I could not see his eyes, nor the plans he'd made before he even saw my face. Seeing the sun on my black hair, he said, cariño, amorcito, and a handful of other words held out like breadcrumbs in his pocketful of New Orleans Spanish. He must have learned those words in a song, but they were enough to coax me from my frayed calico dress. Passing me in the street, el pueblo spit that I was una hija de la mala vida, but a bad life was the only life I'd ever known. I stopped working. We slept together in a clapboard rooming house, ate downstairs with other boarders. Nights he wrapped his arms around my body, pinned my legs with his as if I might fly away. When the landlady began to look at me slant-eyed across the table, I realized he hadn't paid the rent. My gut swirled full of feathers and claws. Look, he said one day, you can work for me, or I go back down that mine shaft. In a year, maybe two, we'll be back in the same fix. I'll be dying or crippled, if not dead, and you'll still have to turn tricks, but I won't be strong enough to protect you. He said it to me like that. He promised it would be easy, that we'd grow fat and rich, that it wouldn't be work at all. We lined up at the justice of the peace. In front of us, a pregnant woman with a bruise across one eye stood arm in arm with a man reeking of whiskey. He married me, and I became Jenny. Only a few people here could utter the sounds of my birth name, Genoveva, and I'd left that old self far away. He bought me a red velvet dress, and I began working out of a crib on Meyer Street, with a narrow bed, a wooden crate, an oil lamp painted with hibiscus flowers. The men called me Mexican Jenny because there were so many Jennies, girls just like me. It's the same. Once in a while, a girl asks what it's like to earn money the way I do. I say it's the same as being married. When they want it, you give in, or risk a twisted arm or a punch. You let them do it to claim a roof, a meal you cook yourself, a wool for a winter coat. It can be sweet with boys fresh to the mines or with older men grateful to touch a woman and willing to pay. The drunks are the worst. At any moment, their bravado sags into gasping snores. I steal from them. Balance against the ones who do their business, then refuse to pay. I could chase these Johns into the street, but that would mean black eyes, broken teeth, the same as my husband gives me when the money doesn't add up at the end of the night. I locked everything that happened deep underground, but the bullet and the jail cell bore into my heart. Outspilled a sky black as crow's wings. When I started that life, I never saw this end. Jenny's mugshot. To the historian, her defiant smile means she was confident she wouldn't be convicted, that she thought her story would be believed. He came at me like so many other times because the money didn't add up. It was Christmas Day. He was drunk. He said he would kill her, but she grabbed the gun. The sounds of blows, curses, and broken furniture were nothing new in Poverty Gulch. No one came at the blast, just as they hadn't come before. For the second time in her life, she took flight, headed for the train, waited for the connection to El Paso. On New Year's Day, they found his body coated with a sheen of ice. But her trail was not yet cold. They say I lied about my age. They say he was my third husband. They say I believed I'd get away. They'll tell you he beat me up, like so many other times, when the money didn't add up. They'll tell you I shot Philip Roberts Jr., a sometimes blacksmith, on Christmas Day, 1912. They'll tell you on New Year's Eve his frozen body was found face down in our cabin in Poverty Gulch. They'll say I ran, that Sheriff Henry Von Fold discovered I'd bought a coach ticket to El Paso, but that the train was delayed and he tracked me. They even say that I swam the Rio Grande into Mexico, though that kind of entrance has never been necessary. They say I joined Pancho Villa's camp followers. Von Fool says he found me at the Capitol Hotel in Ciudad Chihuahua, 250 miles from the border. He said I greeted him warmly and did not resist arrest. He says I volunteered to walk across the border and meet him on the other side. He said I believed I would be found innocent on grounds of self-defense. They're not ashamed to say Von Fool recruited Billy Dingman, a fugitive wanted in Cripple Creek, to help bring me back. In exchange, the file on his case disappeared. It was more important to bring back a prostitute who'd killed her pimp, a wife who'd killed her husband. They wrote murderess across the top of my mugshot. I got life imprisonment for first-degree murder. Jenny's alternate lives. I was born in Colorado, grew up in Walsenburg. My mother was Mexican, my father German. I was happy. I was a runaway. I loved the touch of a man more than anything. When I was arrested, I said that Mrs. O'Connor was my mother, that she lived in Cripple Creek on East Warren Avenue. If these things are true, how did I know the way to El Paso and from there to Ciudad Chihuahua? How did a girl who'd never been outside Colorado know how to get on that train? How did I know where to go? Photo of the sewing workshop at the Colorado State Penitentiary in Canyon City, Colorado. Three women in the foreground pause at their work, stare into the camera lens. One leans her chin on her hand, mocks a gesture of leisure. Perhaps 40 women sit over industrial-sized spools. Half the women sitting straight-backed over the needle, over long tables, over sewing machines, hand cranks, and treadles are black. They stitch shirts and work pants for male prisoners. When men are taken to the whipping post, the old gray mare, the beating shreds their pant seats. The women stitch long plain gowns for the hospital ward, white cotton aprons for the kitchen workers. They sew the long canvas dresses men are forced to wear when guards find them fucking. There are always scraps from this kind of work. Selvages can be pieced into pillow tops, pincushions, small hemmed towels. Table runners with a few French knots can be sold to tourists in the prison gift shop. In the background of the photo, men stand against the walls. Maybe they handled the scissors, snipped thread, cut yardage to keep scissors out of the inmates' sleeves, out of their cells, where they might use them against the guards' wandering hands. The needle is never a threat. Small and inconspicuous, its sharpness isn't considered deadly. Ubiquitous as air, no one would suspect what a needle might do. Prisoner 7178, Canyon City, Colorado. I came to the prison with nothing, but after the trial, bright fabrics from my working clothes, deep blue, rosa mexicana, the pale gold of the wings of golondrinas, were piles of fire in my cell. When I learned to sew in the prison workshop, other women gave me clippings from their own finery. Little by little, I dismantled those dresses into scraps that told my story, beginning with Flor de Jamaica, with swallows and butterflies, with a jungle of bougainvillea and trumpet vines. In the workroom, a girl hands me the needle, saying, "They're called crazy quilts. They can be any crazy thing you can think of. Nothing is straight or even." Those patches were the fractured walkway of my life. I had a great desire to rip everything at the weak points. I took my work clothes and ripped them to ribbons, saved bright patches near seams, velvet trims from waistbands and collars, calico bouquets of roses, ruffles that had swept the streets of Cripple Creek. In the workroom, after each day's sewing was done, the same girl taught me Lazy Daisy, Fern, and Fly Stitch. I decorated those crooked paths, laced them with blues, whites, and greens, with colors of running water. After 6 winters, I got sick. The cough shook me through the night, and in 1920, when I coughed blood into an apron I was sewing, I was paroled. The warden sold the quilt in the prison gift shop. I could be released, but Cripple Creek and even Denver were not suitable for a dangerous woman like me. I was sorry to see the quilt go, but the money bought me a train ticket to El Paso, then on to Ciudad Chihuahua. What could I do but go back to the life, sick as I was? I died turning tricks in Mexico. Home or not, that's where I was buried. Maybe. The warden came for the quilt, and people who had been friends, neighbors, working girls, barmen, bought tickets, 25 cents each, because they wanted the quilt, but also because they wanted me to have a fresh start. The quilt was displayed in the prison gift shop. Even fine people came to see it, to buy tickets and dream of my quilt on their parlor tables, over the backs of their upholstered chairs. Some came because they believed justice had not been done in my case. As they slid their quarters like wishes across the wooden counter, they remembered mothers, sisters, friends, beaten blue, even killed. Some thought of me as a soiled dove, like those in books and newspapers, and believed their money attached them to the borders of my story. The quilt was raffled. I got on the train. The platform was full of well-wishers. Other possibilities. They never knew it, but I got off the train in El Paso, that being as good a place as any. I recovered in the dry desert air and made my living as a seamstress. There were many more quilts embroidered with herons, with storks and pelicans. In the end, I missed the first quilt less and less. Every day I walk past the river, like me a moving thing from far away. Who knows where the current will take me? Who knows how it ends? Thank you. Any questions? Anybody want to talk? Marianne?
Do you have a preferential ending?
Well, it's interesting. I think my endings, one of my endings came out of my original misreading of the story, because when I read this very economical story of how they sold the quilt and sent her back to Mexico, the first thing I thought was, oh, how nice, right? They wanted to do this nice thing. And then the more I read the story, the more I realized they wanted to get rid of her. But I like the last ending the best. I think she got away.
What I like about multiple alternatives to the story and open endings is that they are... all are true.
Yes.
It doesn't really matter of this one woman.
Yeah.
Like there's another woman for whom the other ending is true.
That's right.
And so,
yeah.
So all of them become the story of the women who, girls like me come from.
Yeah. Yeah.
Girls like me come from girls like me, and that the people who bought the 25-cent tickets had mothers and sisters.
Right.
So this is a common experience.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Some part of the story is true for a lot of people. Yeah. 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 Anything else? Okay.
What I wanted to thank you for is that my family, my group, my family.
Oh, yeah.
And he was born in 1800.
Uh-huh.
So I'm pretty much familiar with the whole thing, what happened in and how it impacted the history of Texas.
Right.
I had never heard anybody before put it in the book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It was fun doing that research. There's a great PBS series online about the history of whaling. So if you're interested in that. They don't cover the whaling for cat food part so much, but more the East Coast and, you know, the transatlantic part.
Mm-hmm. So we know that you make quilts and you make shawls out of department meetings, but, you know, when do you write these things? Like, do you carry around a book and think, oh, gosh, I must write a poem about this? Or, I mean, I guess I don't, I know Barbara, but I don't imagine you just, like, going home and turning on a light and typing, like, pad.
No. Yeah, I tend to write just fragments of things that then I come back to when I have more time in the summer. Yeah. And the other thing that was really important for me is 3 years ago I was accepted to Canto Mundo, which is a national program, master poets workshop for Latino poets. And that really gave me a lot of impetus to write more, to take a lot of those fragments and to, you know, spend more time with them than I was. And so having that community for all of you that are writers and that are interested in writing, being part of a community is really essential to your poetic or your other writerly, you know, aspirations. Yeah. So no, I mean, I carry a little notebook. Talk with my students about what kind of notebook. I like the little ones that you can just put in your purse. I tend to keep, like, my to-do list, unfortunately, in the same notebook, right? Yeah, yeah. But just the little parts, you know, very much, I think the metaphor of the crazy quilt works really well. Just you take these little pieces, these little cast-offs, and you piece them together. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that so many of us are captivated by poetry, which has been around a long time? And do you see the increasing use of digital technology? Is that going to add to or subtract from what we care about poems?
Yeah. I think, you know, poetry is experiencing a kind of resurgence because of technology, that there are more and more online journals, and that's wonderful that you can get. In fact, I show my students fairly regularly poets reading on YouTube, right? And so these are things that bring us poetry in new ways. I'm convinced that we're really a narrative culture, right? And so some kinds of poetry are not as fostered as others. And I think, I mean, I've always had this kind of storytelling bent to my own work, and so I think that still has appeal, even though we're in this kind of narrative moment in culture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dorothy Allison is also one of my favorite
authors. Yeah.
She says that for her, the purpose of her writing is to break the heart of the world and heal it.
Yeah.
What do you think the role of piecing stories, words, language, mm-hmm. fabric,
yeah.
means to you?
You know, I think like the story of Mexican Jenny, that, you know, there's this profound silence around the experiences of some people, right? That all we have are these little shards, right? And so I think that is a really valuable resource that we have to really, you know, appreciate those shards that help us to fill out this silence and give voice to a story. But yeah, Dorothy Allison is wonderful. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
You said that the county received was rage.
Mm-hmm.
You're a very, very polite person. Yeah. And you're very diplomatic students.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering what it's like for you to write about rage and if that's something that you tackle more often in your writing.
Yeah, I think it was surprisingly easy. You know, for me, in that poem about the neighbors, it was the memory of them shouting in the middle of the night up and down the stairs, right? And then I think, you know, there are different kinds of rage as well, right? There are some very useful kinds that, again, help us to move forward and do things. Huh? Yeah. Anybody else? Well, you've been very indulgent. Okay.
So I speak as a social scientist colleague who mm-hmm. has sort of a terror of poetry, right? Christina knows that I come to poetry often very intimidated, and she has to help me unpack it. What I find in your poetry, because of the storytelling, is a short story condensed to its bare bones. That is so rich, and what I was really noticing was how your use of adjectives must have been so carefully sought for or found, because I was just thinking about the whaling, and because sailing and seafaring.
Oh, that's right.
You instantly painted a world of the sea with the adjectives you chose.
Mm-hmm.
And I was noticing that pattern throughout. So I guess it's not a question, it's more of a statement of appreciation of seeing that craft. But I guess the question would be, is that a conscious process for you? Do you have a story you tell yourself about how you need to take those fragments and
Yeah. In fact, in that poem, I had even more kind of C words, and I thought, no, that's too much. Cut it back. So then I had, you know, sounding, and I kept listing, but I also had sounding, and so all these other words, and it was just too much, especially all at the end, you know, so I had to pull it back. But yeah, you know, writing, you know, I put down the bare bones, and then you play with the language. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, the way that words work in have multiple meanings helps us, right? It's something that we can use.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I must. I have 20, so I'll ask one more. So there's more and more literature that's coming out with Spanish words that are not necessarily translated, mm-hmm. but you understand them in context.
Yeah.
How much do you like to do it in your poetry, and what do you think about that trend? In the context of English-only poetry.
Yeah, well, that's another good topic. But I noticed that in this poem, I don't think I translated the Spanish very much. And that was, I don't know that was a conscious choice, but I just wanted to maintain the sense of her as somebody with a Mexican context. And so particularly with the names of plants and colors, things like that. And in other works, I've made a more conscious decision to translate. But it may be that the spareness of this particular poem, I decided not to. Well, thank you again. Thank you. I'm just really humbled by this show of support and interest. And let's eat cake.